Action this day. Continued. The train left Montparnasse at exactly 5 minutes after 5 p.m. as SS Hauptsturmfuhrer Bock, Gestapo, 13 rue Madeleine, Paris. Basil did not require anything save his identification papers, since Gestapo membership conferred on him an elite status that no rail clerk in the Wehrmacht monitoring the trains would dare challenge. Thus he flew by the ticket process and the security checkpoints and the flash inspection at the first-class carriage steps. The train eased into motion and picked up speed as it left the marshalling yards, resolving themselves toward blur as the darkness increased. He sat alone amid a smattering of German officers returning to duty after a few stolen nights in Paris. Outside, in the twilight, the little toy train depots of France fled by, and inside the vibration rattled and the grumpy men tried to squeeze in a last bit of relaxation before once again taking up their vexing duties, which largely consisted of waiting until the Allied armies came to blow them up. Some of them thought of glorious death and sacrifice for the fatherland. Some remembered the horrors in whose embraces they had passed the time. Some thought of ways to surrender to the Americans without getting themselves killed, but also of not being reported, for one never knew who was keeping records and who would see them. But most seemed to realize that Basil was an undercover SS officer, and no one wanted to brook any trouble at all with the SS. Again, a wrong word, a misinterpreted joke, a comment too politically frank, and it was off to that dreaded 8.8-centimeter anti-tank gun facing the T-34s and the Russians. All of them preferred their luck with the Americans and the British than with the goddamn Bolsheviks. So Basil sat alone, ramrod straight, looking neither forward nor back. His stern carriage conveyed seriousness of purpose, relenting attention to detail, and a devotion to duty so hard and true it positively radiated heat. He permitted no mirth to show, no human weakness. Most of all, and hardest for him, he allowed himself to show no irony, for irony was the one attribute that would never be found in the SS or in any Hitlerite true believer. In fact, in one sense, the Third Reich and its adventure in mass death was a conspiracy against irony. Perhaps that is why Basil hated it so much and fought it so hard. Bock said nothing. There was nothing to say. Instead, it was Macht who did all the talking. They leaned on the hood of the Citroën radio car in the courtyard of the Bibliothèque Mazarin.
Whatever it was he wanted, he got it. Now he has to get out of town and fast. He knows that sooner or later we may tumble to his acquisition of Airbox identity papers, and at that point their usefulness comes to an abrupt end, and they become absolutely a danger. So he will use them now, as soon as possible, and get as far away as possible.
But he has purposefully refused any resistance aid on this trip, said Abel.
True.
That would mean that he has no radio contact. That would mean that he has no way to set up a Lysander pickup.
Excellent point, Volta. Yes, and that narrows his options considerably. One way out would be to head to the Spanish border. However, that days away involves much travel and the danger of constant security checks, and he would worry that his Bock identity would have been penetrated.
They spoke of Bock as if he were not there. In a sense, he wasn't.
Sir, the breach is frozen.
Kick it, they're almost on us.
I can't, sir. My foot fell off because of frostbite.
He could, I suppose, get to Calais and swim to Dover. It's only 32 kilometers. It's been done before.
Even by a woman.
Still, although he's a gifted professional, I doubt they have anyone quite that gifted. And even if it's spring, the water is 4 or 5 degrees centigrade.
Yes, said Macht, but he will definitely go by water. He will head to the most accessible seaport. Given his talents for subversion, he will find some sly fisherman who knows our patrol boat patterns and pay the fellow to haul him across. He can make it in a few hours, swim the last 100 yards to a British beach, and be home with his treasure, whatever that is.
If he escapes, we should shoot the entire staff of the Bibliothèque Mazarine, said Bach suddenly. This is on them. He stole my papers, yes. He pickpocketed me. But he could have stolen anyone's papers, so to single me out is rather senseless. I will make that point in my report.
An excellent point, said Macht. Alas, I will have to add that while he could have stolen anyone's papers, he did steal yours, and they were immensely valuable to him. He is now sitting happily on the train, thinking of the jam and buns he will enjoy tomorrow morning with his tea and whether it will be a DSC or a DSO that follows his name from now on. I would assume that as an honorable German officer, you will take full responsibility. I really don't think we need to go shooting up any library staffs at this point. Why don't we concentrate on catching him? And that will be that.
Bach meant to argue, but saw that it was useless. He settled back into his bleakness and said nothing.
The first thing. Which train? Macht inquired of the air.
The air had no answer, and so he answered it himself.
Assuming that he left, as Le Directeur said, at exactly 3:45 p.m. by cab, he got to the Montparnasse station by 4:15. Using his SS papers, he would not need to stand in line for tickets or checkpoints, so he could leave almost immediately. My question thus has to be, what trains leaving for coastal destinations were available between 4:15 and 4:45? He will be on one of those trains. Walter, please call the detectives.
Abel spoke into the microphone by radio to his headquarters and waited. A minute later an answer came. He conveyed it to the two officers.
A train for Cherbourg left at 4:30, due to arrive in that city at 11:30 p.m. Then another at...
That's fine. He'd take the first. He doesn't want to be standing around not knowing where we are in our investigations, and thus assuming the worst. Now, Walter, please call up their headquarters and get our people at Montparnasse to check the gate of that train for late-arriving German officers. I believe they have to sign a travel manifest. At least, I always do. See if Hauptsturmführer... Ah, what's the first name, Bach?
Otto.
SS Hauptsturmführer Otto Bock, Gestapo, came aboard at the last moment.
Yes, sir.
Macht looked over at Bock.
Well, Hauptsturmführer, if this pans out, we may save you from your 8.8 in Russia.
I serve where I help the Führer best. My life is of no consequence, said Bock darkly.
You may feel somewhat differently when you see the tanks on the horizon, said Macht.
It hardly matters. We can never catch him. He has too much head start. We can order the train met at Cherbourg, I suppose, and perhaps they will catch him.
Unlikely. This eel is too slippery.
Please, tell me you have a plan.
Of course I have a plan, said Macht.
All right, yes, said Abel, turning from the phone. Hauptsturmführer Bock did indeed come aboard at the last moment. He sat. The train shook, rattled, and clacked. Twilight passed into lightless night. The vibrations played across everything. Men smoked, men drank from flasks, men tried to write letters home or read. It was not an express, so every half hour or so the train would lurch to a stop and one or two officers would leave, one or two would join. The lights flickered, cool air blasted into the compartment, the French conductor yelled the meaningless name of the town, and on they went, into the night. At last the conductor yelled,
Blickbeck, 20 minutes,
first in French, then in German. He stood up, leaving his overcoat, and went to the loo. In it, he looked at his face in the mirror, sallow in the light. He soaked a towel, rubbed his face, meaning to find energy somehow. Action this day. Much of it. A last trick. A last wiggle. The fleeing agent's enemy is paranoia. Basil had no immunity from it, merely discipline against it. He was also not particularly immune to fear. He felt both of these emotions strongly now, knowing that this nothingness of waiting for the train to get him where it had to was absolutely the worst. But then he got his war face back on, forcing the armor of his charm and charisma to the surface, willing his eyes to sparkle, his smile to flash, his brow to furl romantically. He was back in character. He was Basil again.
"Excellent," said Macht. "Now, Bock, your turn to contribute. Use that SS power of yours we all so fear, and call von Koltitz adjutant. It is important that I be given temporary command authority over a unit called Nachtjagdgeschwader 9. Luftwaffe, of course. It's a wing headquartered at a small airfield near the town of Briekbeck, less than 1 hour outside Cherbourg. Perhaps you remember our chat with its commandant, Oberst Gunther Scholl, a few days ago. Well, you had better hope that Oberst Scholl is on his game, because he is the one who will nab Johnny England for us."
Quite unexpectedly, Bock didn't understand. Puzzlement flashed in his eyes and fuddled his face. He began to stutter, but Abel cut him off.
"Please, Herr Hauptsturmführer, time is fleeting."
Bock did what he was told, telling his Uber-Hauptsturmführer that Hauptmann Dieter Macht of Abwehr 3B needed to give orders to Oberst Scholl of NJG-9 at Briekbeck. Then the three got into the Citroen and drove the 6 blocks back to the Hotel Duval, where they went quickly to the phone operator at the board. Though the Abwehr men were sloppy by SS standards, they were efficient by German standards. The operator handed a phone to Macht, who didn't bother to shed his trench coat and fedora.
"Hello, hello," he said. "Hauptmann Macht here. Call for Oberst Scholl." "Yes, I'll wait."
A few seconds later, Scholl came on the phone.
"Scholl here."
"Yes, Oberst Scholl. It's Hauptmann Macht, Paris Abwehr. Have things been explained to you?"
"Hello, Macht. I know only that by emergency directive from Luftwaffe Command, I am to obey your orders."
"Do you have planes up tonight?"
"No, the bomber streams are heading north tonight. We have the night off."
"Sorry to make the boys work, Herr Oberst. It seems your seatmate is returning to your area. I need manpower. I need you to meet and cordon off the Cherbourg train at the Briekbeck stop. It's due in at 11:30 p.m. Maximum effort. Get your pilots out of bed or out of the bars or brothels, and your mechanics, your ground crews, your fuelers. Leave only a skeleton crew in the tower. I'll tell you why in a bit."
"I must say, Macht, this is unprecedented."
"Oberst, I'm trying to keep you from the Russian front. Please comply enthusiastically, so that you can go back to your three mistresses and your wine cellar."
"How did—"
"We have records, Herr Oberst. Anyhow, I would conceal the men in the bushes and inside the depot house until the train has all but arrived. Then, on command, they are to take up positions surrounding the train, making certain that no one leaves. At that point, I want you to lead a search party from one end to the other, though of course start in first class. You know who you are looking for. He is now, however, in a dark blue pinstriped suit, double-breasted. He has a dark overcoat. He may look older, more abused, harder, somehow different from when you last saw him. You must be alert. Do you understand?"
"Is he armed?"
"We don't know. Assume he is. Listen here, there's a tricky part. When you see him, you must not react immediately. Do you understand? Don't make eye contact. Don't move fast or do anything stupid. He has an L pill. It will probably be in his mouth. If he sees you coming for him, he will bite it. Strychnine. Instant. It would mean so much more if we could take him alive. He may have many secrets, do you understand?"
"I do."
"When you take him, order your officers to go first for his mouth, They have to get fingers or a plug or something deep into his throat to keep him from biting or swallowing. Then turn him face down and pound hard on his back. He has to cough out that pill.
My people will be advised. I will obviously be there to supervise.
Oberst, this chap is very efficient, very practiced. He's an old dog with miles of travel on him. For years he's lasted in a profession where most perish in a week. Be very careful. Be very astute. Be very sure. I know you can do this.
I will catch your spy for you, Macht.
Excellent. One more thing. I will arrive within 2 hours in my own Storch, with my assistant, Abel.
That's right, you fly.
I do, yes. I have over 1,000 hours, and you know how forgiving a Storch is.
I do.
So alert your tower people. I'll buzz them so they can light a runway for the 30 seconds it takes me to land. Then go back to Blackout, and leave a car and driver to take me to the station.
I will.
Good hunting.
Good flying.
He put the phone down, turned to Abel and said,
Call the airport. Get the plane flight checked and fueled so that we can take off upon arrival.
Yes, sir.
One moment, said Bock.
Yes, Herr Hauptsturmführer.
As this is a joint SS Abwehr operation, I demand to be a part of it. I will go along with you.
The plane only holds 2. It loses its agility when a 3rd is added. It's not a fighter. It's a kite with a tiny motor.
Then I will go instead of Abel. Macht, do not fight me on this. I will go to SS and hire if I need to. SS must be represented all through this operation.
You trust my flying?
Of course.
Good, because Abel does not. Now let's go.
Not quite yet. I have to change into my uniform.
Refreshed, Basil left the loo, but instead of turning back into the carriage and returning to his seat, he turned the other way, as if it were the natural thing to do, opened the door at the end of the carriage and stepped out onto the rattling, trembling running board over the coupling between carriages. He waited for the door behind him to seal, tested for speed. Was the train slowing? He felt it was, as maybe the vibrations were further apart, signifying that the wheels churned slightly less aggressively, against an incline on the downhill, perhaps negotiating a turn. Then, without a thought, he leaped sideways into the darkness.
Will I be lucky? Will the famous St. Florian charm continue? Will I float to a soft landing and roll through the dirt? Only my dignity and my hair must? Or will this be the night it all runs out, and I hit a bridge abutment, a tree trunk, a barbed wire fence, and kill myself?
He felt himself elongate as he flew through the air, and as his leap carried him out of the gap between the 2 cars, the slipstream hit him hard, sending his arms and legs flying wildly. He seemed to hang in the darkness for an eternity, feeling the air beat him, hearing the roar of both the wind and the train, seeing nothing. Then he hit. Stars exploded, suns collapsed, the universe split atomically, releasing a tidal wave of energy. He tasted dust, felt pain and a searing jab in his back, then high-speed abrasion of his whole body, a piercing blow to his left hand, had the illusion of rolling, sliding, falling, hurting all at once, and then he lay quiet.
Am I dead?
He seemed not to be. The train was gone now. He was alone in the track bed, amid a miasma of dust and blood. At that point, the pain clamped him like a vice, and he felt himself wounded, though how badly was yet unknown. Could he move? Was he paralyzed? Had he broken any bones? He sucked in oxygen, hoping for restoration. It came, marginally. He checked his hip pocket to see if his Browning 380 was still there, and there indeed it was. He reached next for his shin, hoping and praying that the Minox had survived the descent and landfall. It wasn't there. The prospect of losing it was so tragically immense that he could not face it, and exiled the possibility from his brain as he found the tape, still tight, followed it around, and in 1 second touched the aluminum skin of the instrument. Somehow the impact of the fall had moved it around his leg, but had not sundered, only loosened the tape. He pried it out, slipped it into his hip pocket. He slipped the Browning into his belt in the small of his back, then counted to 3, and stood. His clothes were badly tattered, and his left arm so severely ripped he could not straighten it. His right knee had punched through the cheap, pin-striped serge, and it, too, had been shredded by abrasions. But the real damage was done to his back, where he'd evidently encountered a rock or a branch as he decelerated in the dust, and it hurt immensely. He could almost feel it bruising, and he knew it would pain him for weeks. When he twisted, he felt shards of glass in his side and assumed he'd broken or cracked several ribs. All in all, he was a mess. But he was not dead, and he was more or less ambulatory. He recalled the idiot Luftwaffe colonel on the ride down.
"Yes, our squadron is about a mile east of the tracks, just out of town. It's amazing how the boys have dressed it up. You should come and visit us soon, monsieur. I'll take you on a tour. Why, they've turned a rude military installation in the middle of nothing into a comfortable small German town, with sewers and sidewalks and streets, even a gazebo for summertime concerts. My boys are the best, and our wing does more than its share against the Tommy bombers."
That put the airfield a mile or so ahead, given that the tracks had to run north-south. He walked, sliding between trees and gentle undergrowth, through a rather civilized little forest, actually, and his night vision soon arrived through his headache and the pain in his back, which turned his walk into Frankenstein's lumber, but he was confident he was headed in the right direction. And very shortly he heard the approaching buzz of a small plane and knew absolutely that he was on track. The Storch glided through the air, its tiny engine buzzing away smoothly like a hummingbird's heart. Spindly from its over-engineered landing gear and graceless on the ground, it was a princess in the air. Macht held it at 450 meters, compass heading almost due south. He'd already landed at the big Luftwaffe base at Caen for a refueling, just in case Briekbeck proved outside the Storch's 300-kilometer range. He'd follow the same route back, taking the same fuel precautions. He knew, in the air, take nothing for granted. The western heading would bring him to the home of NJG-9 very soon, as he was flying throttle open close to 175 kilometers per hour. It was a beautiful little thing, light and reliable. You could feel that it wanted to fly, unlike the planes of the Great War, which had mostly been underpowered and over-engineered so close to the maximum they seemed to want to crash. You had to fight to keep them in the air, while the Storch would fly all night if it could. A little cool air rushed in as the Perspex window was cranked half down. It kept the men cool. It also kept them from chatting, which was fine with Macht. It let him concentrate and enjoy, and he still loved the joy of being airborne. Below, rural France slipped by, far from absolutely dark, but too dark to make out details. That was fine. Macht, a good flyer, trusted his compass and his watch and knew that neither would let him down, and when he checked the time, he saw that he was entering NJG-9's airspace. He picked up his radio phone, clicked it a few times, and said,
"Anton, Anton, this is Bertha 9-9, do you read?"
The headset crackled and snapped, and he thought perhaps he was on the wrong frequency, but then he heard,
"Bertha 9-9, this is Anton. I have you. I can hear you. You're bearing a little to the southwest. I'd bear a few degrees to the north."
"Excellent, and thanks, Anton."
"When I have you overhead, I'll light a runway."
"Excellent, excellent. Thanks again, Anton."
Macht made the slight correction and was rewarded a minute later with the sudden flash to illumination of a long horizontal V. It took seconds to find the line into the darkness between the arms of the V, which signified the landing strip. He eased back on the throttle, hearing the engine's RPMs drop, watched his airspeed indicator fall to 75, then 65, eased the stick forward into a gentle incline, came into the cone of lights, and saw grass on either side of a wide tarmac built for the much larger twin-engine ME-110 night fighters, throttled down some more and alit with just the slightest of bumps. When the plane's weight overcame its decreasing power, it almost came to a halt, but he revved back to taxi speed, saw the curved roofs of hangars ahead, and taxied toward them. A broad staging area before the four arched buildings where the fighters paused and made a last check before deploying was before him. He took the plane to it, pivoted it to face outward bound down the same runway, and hit the kill switch. He could hear the vibrations stop, and the plane went silent. Basil watched the little plane taxi to the hangars, pause, then helpfully turn itself back to the runway. Perfect. Whoever was flying was counting on a quick trip back and didn't want to waste time on the ground. He crouched well inside the wire about 300 meters from the plane, which put him 350 meters from the four hangars. He knew, because Oberst Scholl had told him, that recent manpower levies had stripped the place of guards and security people, all of whom were now in transit to Russia, where their bodies were needed urgently to feed into the fire. As for the patrol dogs, one had died of food poisoning and the other was so old he could hardly move, again information provided by Scholl. The security of NJG-9's night fighter base was purely an illusion. All non-essential personnel had been stripped away for something big in Russia. In each hangar, Basil could see the prominent outlines of the big night fighters, each cockpit slid open, resting at the nose-up, tail-down, 15-degree angle on the buttress of the two sturdy landing gears that descended from the huge bulge of engines on the broad wings. They were not small airplanes, and these birds wore complex nests of prongs on the nose, radar antenna meant to guide them to the bomber stream 7,600 meters above. The planes were all marked by the stark black Luftwaffe cross insignia, and their metallic snouts gleamed slightly in the lights until the tower turned them off when the Storch had come to a safe stop. He watched carefully. Two men. One wore a pilot's leather helmet but not a uniform, just a tent of a trench coat that hadn't seen cleaning or pressing in years. He was the pilot, and he tossed the helmet into the plane along with an unplugged set of headphones. At the same time, he pulled out a battered fedora, which looked like it had been crushed in the pocket of the coat for all the years it hadn't been pressed or cleaned. Number two was more interesting. He was SS, totally, completely avatar of dark style and darker menace. The uniform, jodhpurs and boots under a smart tunic, tight at the neck, black cap with death heads rampant in silver above the bill at a rakish angle, was more dramatic than the man who appeared porky and graceless. He was shakier than the pilot, taking a few awkward steps to get his land legs back and drive the dizziness from his mind. In time, a Mercedes staff car arrived from somewhere in the darkness, driven by a Luftwaffe who leapt out and offered a snappy salute. He did not shake hands with either, signifying his enlisted status as against their commissions, but obsequiously retreated to the car, where he opened the rear door. The two officers slid in. The driver resumed his place behind the wheel, and the car sped away into the night.
"Yes, that's very good, Sergeant," said Macht as the car drove in darkness between the tower and administration complex on the left and the officers' mess on the right. The gate was a few hundred meters ahead.
"Now, very quickly, let us out and continue on your way outside the gate along the road and back to the station at Breekbeck, where your commanding officer waits."
Sir, my instructions are..."
"Do as I say, Sergeant, unless you care to join the other bad boys of the Wehrmacht on an infantry salient on some frozen hill of dog shit in Russia."
"Obviously, sir, I will obey."
"I thought you might."
The car slipped between two buildings, slowed, and Macht eased out, followed by Bock. Then the car rolled away, speeded up, and loudly issued the pretense that it was headed to town with two important passengers.
"Marked," hissed Bock. "What in the devil's name are you up to?"
"Use your head, Herr Hauptsturmführer. Our friend is not going to be caught like a fish in a bucket. He's too clever. He presumes the shortest possible time between his escape from Paris and our ability to figure it out and know what name he travels under. He knows he cannot make it all the way to Cherbourg and steal or hire a boat. No, indeed, and since that idiot Scholl has conveniently plied him with information about the layout and operational protocols of NJG-9, as well as, I'm certain, a precise location, he has identified it as his best opportunity for an escape. He means, I suppose, to fly to England in a 110 like the madman Hess, but we have provided him with a much more tempting conveyance— the low, slow, gentle Storch. He cannot turn it down, do you see? It is absolutely his best, his only chance of bringing off his crazed mission, whatever it is. But we will stop him. Is that pistol loaded?"
Bock slapped the Luger under the flap of his holster on his ceremonial belt.
"Of course. One never knows."
"Well, then, we shall get as close as possible and wait for him to make his move. I doubt he's a quarter kilometer from us now. He'll wait until he's certain the car is gone and the lazy Luftwaffe tower personnel are paying no attention, and then he'll dash to the airplane, and off he goes."
"We will be there," said Bock, pulling his Luger.
"Put that thing away, please, Herr Hauptsturmführer. It makes me nervous."